Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We are getting closer to the present in our series with the historian Gary Gerstle about the ideas behind American presidential elections. Today, we have reached 1980 and the election of Ronald Reagan as President of the United States. It was widely seen, then and now, as a watershed in American history and a turning point. Was it? And if so, what was America turning from, and what was America turning to? Gary, I want to ask you, as a historian, before we talk about the details of what happened in 1980, just to get your sense of the man who was president, but who would lose the presidency that year, Jimmy Carter. So amazingly, as we record this, and I say that with reason, he's still alive. He's 99 years old, an extraordinarily long life and an extraordinarily long post-presidential life, in which his reputation has shifted in various ways. But for most of my adult life, when I started studying politics and became interested in American politics, relatively long period after this, you know, the following decades or two, Carter seemed to symbolize a failed presidency. He was a one-term president, but he was held up sometimes as a man who was out of his depth. I think quite a few American presidents probably have been out of their depth, and in the 19th century, probably more out of their depth than in their depth. But Carter, I mean, he had a pretty poor reputation in the decades after his presidency. So when you look at the Carter presidency now, do you see a man who was out of his depth? Was he overpromoted by the American people?
Yes. I do not share in a certain Carter revisionism that is apparent in the academy among scholars. It is true that he arguably has had one of the most successful post-presidential lives of any president and one of the longest. An honorable man of ethics who I respect enormously as an individual, a principled man. But I don't think he had a successful presidency, partly due to his own inexperience and limitations, and partly due to the moment in which he was president. This was a moment where I think anyone would have had a great deal of difficulty. Americans love to fall in love with presidents who come out of nowhere, thinking that they're unsullied by politics. There's an understanding in America that there's so much corruption, there's so much graft, there's so much distrust of government that what the nation needs is someone unsullied by all of that to come in and clean things up. And this is a particularly intense feeling in the mid-70s in the aftermath of Watergate. And Carter was such a man. He was not a corrupt figure. He had an okay governorship of Georgia, but he was pure. He was principled. He was going to clean up Washington. The problem with falling in love with someone without experience is that they are now immediately being asked to manage one of the biggest enterprises in the world, and they don't have the experience necessary to do that. I would fault the American people in this case for falling in love once again with someone not adequate to the task. But let me also be clear about the situation with which he was dealing. He not only has to deal with the legacy of the 60s, the civil rights revolution, the angry standoff between whites and non-whites in American society, the effects of the counterculture, the liberation movements. Women's movements were particularly strong. The new left had fragmented, but out of those fragments come powerful new groups that put new issues on the agenda. Black power is one, feminism is another. There are a lot of new forces that have been unleashed in American politics. In addition to that, there are major shocks to the American economy that arise from sources outside the United States that Carter has no control over, but that he has to deal with. And one is the petroleum crisis. The trigger was the Yom Kippur War between Israel and its Arab neighbors in 73. Another trigger, the Iranian Revolution of the late 70s, both of which result for a time in the shutoff of the flow of cheap oil to the West. The global North depends on plentiful supplies of very cheap oil. The extraction of how much oil from the ground, the price at which it was going to be sold until that point had been controlled mostly by Anglo-American petroleum companies, and then Saudi Arabia and its allies in the Middle East and elsewhere say, we are going to set the terms for this. And so the global North industrial economies accustomed to tremendously cheap oil now have a major, major petroleum crisis on their hands, and they're unprepared for it. The other element is changing relations between the industrial economies of the global North. The U.S. has been undertaking to rebuild the countries it vanquished in World War II, Germany and Japan, and they come online in a very powerful way in the 1970s and are competitive with America in key industries, and the U.S. is not prepared for that competition. Automobiles, steel manufacturing, electronics. And so the U.S. is subjected to these extraordinary inflationary shocks arising from the petroleum crisis on the one hand, and industries failing because they are not as efficient as the industries of Germany and Japan, which have much more modernized equipment and much more streamlined production lines. And so you have a combination of mounting inflation and serious unemployment as big American industries in the U.S. begin to crater. None of this is of Carter's doing. It's not of any president's doing, really. But these are profound changes in political economy, geopolitics, and Carter is the first president to have to deal with those shocks. And there would have been better presidents, but the point is anyone would have difficulty mastering these new challenges.
As you describe it there, Gary, you've got a president who's not up to it, and then the task is probably too big for anyone. It sounds like an overwhelming challenge, and therefore this election, plot spoiler, Carter's going to lose, and he's going to lose badly to Ronald Reagan, is a foregone conclusion. These are economic shocks. We know economic shocks are often the single biggest driver of shifts in voting patterns. And it doesn't matter if it's not the president's fault. There's been a huge amount of research that shows that voters aren't interested in finding the person to blame. That is, who deserves the blame. They're interested in finding someone to blame. So with hindsight, Carter looks doomed. And yet, for a long period in 1980, people thought the election was very close. And it seemed to turn on a range of contingencies. So that's what's baked in. And what's baked in looks like it's pointing to a defeat for Jimmy Carter. But then a number of things happen. And the thought is always with contingencies, had they not happened, maybe it would have gone a different way. So one of them is the Tehran hostage crisis. So as a result of the revolution in Iran, Americans are taken hostage in the American embassy in Tehran. This becomes a huge issue in American politics, and it's a driving story on the news every night. You know, the number of days they've been held ticks up, tick, tick, tick. And Carter launched what, with hindsight, looks like a fairly harebrained scheme to rescue the hostages in 1980, and it failed. It didn't get anywhere near, and it was a disaster, and it cost the lives of some Americans who were involved in it. But had it worked, would we be telling a different story here? Or was this baked in? I mean, there's no way of knowing with that kind of counterfactual. But nonetheless, certainly at the time, it felt like Carter had taken a gamble trying to rescue the hostages, and he lost. The implication being, if it's a real gamble, had he won, had he effected some miraculous rescue operation, history would be different.
There's no doubt that the failed rescue effort sealed the coffin. The man can't manage the economy. He can't bring inflation down. He can't bring the unemployment rate down. And he can't even get a U.S. military helicopter to its destination. It's worth pointing out that it's not as though the helicopters reached Tehran and they lost a battle. They crashed in the desert due to a sandstorm. And I remember people thinking, didn't they take precautions? It's a desert. Didn't they take precautions? Didn't they understand the threat of sand getting into the motors and bringing these aircraft down? It just seemed so elementary, and it seemed to confirm people in their sense of incompetence. I guess the question is, was this a reasonable gamble? Or was it already a sign of desperation? Could it have succeeded if it had been planned better? I think there's no doubt that if he had been successful in rescuing the hostages, it would have given him a huge boost in American politics. But let's not underestimate the difficulty of pulling this off. The number of hostages that had to be rescued in a crowded urban space. Was the American military force adequate? There could have been a gun battle. Hostages could have been killed. It seems to me, looking at this then and also from a distance, that the chances of success of that were never very great. And so I judge it to be more an act of desperation than a shrewd move that could have turned the election. On the other hand, if it had a 20 to 25% chance of succeeding and it had succeeded, there's no doubt it would have strengthened Carter where he was seen to be weak, indecisive, bumbling, reluctant to use the U.S. military. It would have been a demonstration of power in the world, and it would have demonstrated his ability to strike back at those who labeled the U.S. as the great Satan.
Another sign of his weakness was that he faced a very strong challenge in the primaries as an incumbent president from the third of the Kennedy brothers, Teddy Kennedy. Complicated figure in American political life, dogged at this period by scandal, the Chappaquiddick scandal, when he drove a car off a bridge and a young woman died and he didn't report the death. And anyone who's seen All the President's Men will know Nixon had a file on Chappaquiddick. Nixon's fear was always running against a Kennedy. And as he said in 68, that was his fear. He was relieved of that fear by circumstance and tragedy. His fear in 72 was that he might run against Teddy Kennedy. He wasn't going to run in 76, but Kennedy tried to get the nomination from Carter. And he didn't come that close, but it was pretty hotly contested, and he got more than a third of the total vote share among Democratic primary voters. It's a sign of Carter's weakness. Any one-term president who's challenged in that way, it tends to be one of the signals they're really in trouble in the general election. George H.W. Bush was challenged in 1992 by Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan was never going to win the nomination, but it was a sign that Bush was in trouble. Presidents who win two terms tend not to face a primary challenge. Was Kennedy challenging him from the left? Was Kennedy, so this is evidence of Carter's weakness, but was this also a harbinger of some of the future direction of travel of the Democratic Party? Was Kennedy closer to a politician who stood for the future of the party than Carter was? And after all, Kennedy was also a Massachusetts politician challenging a politician of the South.
Kennedy stood for the older Democratic Party, and Carter stood for the newer Democratic Party. That's what's most interesting about that standoff. But let me first say that I think Kennedy was not equal to the challenge. If I'm to be fair in my judgments, I wouldn't just say that Carter was not adequate to the challenge of the presidency. I think Kennedy was not adequate to the challenge of being a challenger to a sitting president. Life rocked by scandal. Also, the burden of being the last of four brothers, all three others killed, the youngest, the burden on that.
And we should say that when you say three others killed, the oldest Kennedy brother of all was killed in the Second World War. The one that Joe Kennedy, the paterfamilias, thought was going to be the future of the Klan, died really young.
And the future president of the United States, yes, died really young.
He went for JFK as the second best.
Second best, JFK killed, Bobby Kennedy killed, all men in their youth. And you think of the burden that he had to carry. He was also the youngest. He was the baby, often treated as such. And I don't think he had the stature or the competence in the late 70s to be a strong president of the United States. I think he's later going to get that stature once he could resist the lure of the presidency and simply settle into being a senior statesman in the Senate. I think he reaches that point, and sometime in the late 80s and through the 90s, he becomes a very senior and important figure. There's a moment when he is interviewed by Roger Mudd on CBS News in 1980 about why he wants to run for the presidency, and he has no coherent answer to give.
Except he's a Kennedy.
And that's a very revealing moment. It's a way of him saying, I don't really want to be here. I'm not ready for this, but I have an obligation to my dead brothers and my father to carry on the Kennedy dynasty. That's how I interpreted that moment. Now, having said that, what makes this contest interesting is that Kennedy represents much more the Democratic Party of FDR. Well, Carter is beginning to move the Democratic Party in a neoliberal direction. So Kennedy gets the support of unions. He trumpets support for full employment policies. He wants to expand the regulatory state. Carter's most interesting and innovative policies have to do with deregulation. He's deregulating the airplane industry. He's deregulating trucking. He's beginning a process of deregulating telecommunications. He wants to shrink government. He wants to introduce more of a market and corral the influence of the big state on the private economy. So he is the first of the new Democrats, and Kennedy comes to embody one of the last of the old Democrats. And that is a fight that is going on within the Democratic Party. Now that the Vietnam issue is out of the way, the issue that consumes the Democratic Party is to what degree will this party continue to be the heir of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal? And to what extent is the crisis of the 1970s demanding a different set of policies, a different toolkit? Kennedy says, Keynesianism has been the toolkit we've used for the last 30 years. It still works. I'm with it. And Carter is the one who's beginning to move away from that. That is what makes the contest between those two candidates so interesting. They embody these two very different tendencies, old and new, and those are going to continue to divide the Democratic Party until the Democratic Party sides with the heir of Carter, a man by the name of Bill Clinton.
What makes Kennedy a complicated figure here is part of what you described there is almost a reactionary or small-c conservative version. This worked for us in the past, let's cling on to it. But as you also say, his was the longer career. Carter's career in electoral politics is over when he loses. Kennedy is a significant figure in the Democratic Party right through to the presidency of Barack Obama. And he is both reactionary, but also in some ways to the left. So he is to the left in what you've just described. If Carter is inching in a neoliberal direction, he's still holding on to some of the traditional institutions of left-ish politics in the United States, trade unionism, and so on. And later on in his career, he does represent certain other left-ish causes in the Senate, including around some of the issues of identity politics, which are going to be part of the future of the Democratic Party. So Teddy Kennedy's a really interesting figure. He's both backward-looking and forward-looking. And he's also forward-looking almost to the presidency of Joe Biden. I mean, that's the other way in which Carter points to Bill Clinton, but Teddy Kennedy, you know, almost points to the New Deal politics that we have today.
I do agree with you that Teddy Kennedy grows into the left version of him that you've just described. I don't think it's fully formed in the 70s, which is what makes his presidential run premature. But I think he is going to grow into it, and he becomes a very significant voice counseling against all those other Democrats who want to pull the Democratic Party to the right. He becomes a very important and steadfast advocate of what we might call a social democratic strain in Democratic Party politics. What makes that interesting is that the Kennedy family itself did not embody that social democratic strain. And so he comes to a place where he inhabits something distinct from his brothers. It's a major achievement on his part. As for him prefiguring Biden,
I don't think he prefigures Biden, but what's interesting is how these questions straddle these generational divides. In the 70s, looking back makes him a relic of the past and Carter is looking forward. But we're now in a politics where some of the more radical policies are the ones that are looking back to the earlier New Deal settlement for the 21st century. But nonetheless, you bridge the Carter-Clinton years in a politics now that has some of its roots in the earlier politics of the New Deal era.
What I see as bringing Biden and Kennedy together is that they both end up in unexpected places. They both come to embody a politics that did not animate them in the early years of their career. And just as Kennedy comes to embody within the Democratic Party an identifiable left of center position, Biden is going to come to inhabit the same space, but that is not the Biden of the 1990s or 1980s. And so it's the story of two politicians with electoral success and long presence in the Senate, but in both cases, taking a while to find their voice. And when they find that voice, it is surprisingly unconventional and innovative, which one would not have predicted for either man looking at them earlier in their careers.
So let's talk about Ronald Reagan, another extraordinary figure with an astonishing life in American politics. In 1980, I was young, I was 13. I remember this election, and in Europe, in Britain, Ronald Reagan was a joke. He clearly was not a joke. He was a serious and incredibly skillful politician. But Carter was a bit of a joke too, actually. So it's like a joke versus joke, not in any way a fair representation of what was really going on here. But the other thing about Reagan is that he had a dual reputation, even beyond that sort of derisive European patronizing view, which is, on the one hand, he was the optimist. He was going to make America smile again and feel good about itself again. And on the other hand, he was a scaremonger. He was a kind of Cold War scaremonger. He wanted to frighten people, particularly about the threat of the Soviet Union. You've got to be a really skillful politician to be an optimistic scaremonger or a frightening optimist, whatever it was. And I think there is something in that. He was both of these things, wasn't he? I mean, his candidacy in some ways was built around these two things. Genuine optimism. He was quite a sunny person in a way. But also, there was an apocalyptic strain to his politics.
Absolutely. On the one hand, the Soviet Union, in his language, was the evil empire, which was shocking to hear in America after the period of détente that Nixon inaugurated, and that Carter, despite his militance about the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, continued to hear this really frank talk about an evil empire that could not be allowed to exist. Discussion of modest nuclear weapons that might have to be deployed on battlefields in Europe was part of his bargain. But if we compare him to a scaremonger like Trump, what distinguishes Reagan is his belief in the American dream, and that it would, under his presidency, become morning in America once again. And he delivered that message with conviction and hope and ultimately persuasion. A tremendous number of people in America reacted positively to his vision of America as a city on a hill that perhaps had lost its way, but would soon regain it and once again become the last best hope for mankind. And he communicated both the threats and the optimism with conviction and with sincerity, and he could pivot from one to the other quite quickly. One of the most controversial policies that he pursued, and there were many controversial policies he pursued in the 1980s, was the so-called Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, in which he imagined building a dome over America, a digital dome that would protect America from any incoming Soviet nuclear missiles or missiles from North Korea. The U.S. would have the technology to intercept every one of them, no matter how many were coming. And this would enable America to abandon its policy of mutually assured destruction. It would change the game in terms of nuclear brinkmanship. He was ridiculed for this in the United States. The U.S. doesn't have the technology. If 1,000 missiles are pouring in, how could this Iron Dome of America possibly stop them all? But this didn't deter Reagan, who pursued this. And even as he was being ridiculed in the United States, the man who felt this threat very deeply and keenly was a man by the name of Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, who worried that this could become a reality and the Soviet Union could not build a similar strategic defense initiative, rendering it newly vulnerable in the Cold War. And this leads Gorbachev to send out some feelers of peace and negotiation to this arch Cold Warrior who sees the Soviet Union as the evil empire. And to a surprising degree, Reagan accepts these peace feelers and arranges peace talks with Gorbachev in the 1980s. This is an example of him pivoting from scaremongering to optimism, from pivoting from a position of putting the U.S. in the position of being the unilateral power in the Cold War to dominate the world for the sake of safety, to talking with Gorbachev in the late 80s about massive nuclear disarmament to the point where he's scaring some of his advisors that he's giving up too much too quickly. I think this illustrates the two Reagans, and it also reveals a side of him that escapes the attention of a lot of people, that he had a strategic sense, that his pivoting from scaremongering to negotiation and optimism was not just because he didn't know who he was, but that he was using the threats to good effect. And it suggests that he was a far more sophisticated thinker and strategist than he's usually being given credit for. My memories of the 1980s are man's not equipped to be president. He's an entertainer, not a politician. He can't remember the last book he read. He can't separate fiction from truth. He tells stories and parables that are populated by Hollywood characters who never existed in real life. He's scary to have in a position of that kind of leadership. I've had to revise my view of Reagan. I now take him much more seriously as a serious man, a consequential president, with certain views and visions of how the world ought to be ordered that he had consistently developed since the late 40s and early 50s. So it's wrong to see him as a washed-up Hollywood star simply looking for another vocation for a few years. He had a vision for how to reorganize the world and how to reorganize the American economy, which makes him, in my view, one of the most consequential presidents of the 20th century, probably second only to Franklin Roosevelt.
What I'm struck by, some of the things that he said, some of his speeches, so like you say, he has a reputation as a folksy storyteller. He actually gave quite a lot of very serious speeches that did try and lay out a really broad kind of intellectual ambition for how he saw the world. Now, I'm guessing he didn't write these speeches himself, but he delivered them with conviction. And some of them are the kinds of speeches that are more serious and actually in their way more intellectual than any politician would make today. There's one example here. So I'm going to read this one, not because I'm going to do an American accent, because he gave this one in Britain. But in 1982, probably peak mockery of Reagan. Reagan comes to give a address in 1982 to the Houses of Parliament, as presidents occasionally do. I'm just going to read a bit of this speech. It's really hard to imagine any contemporary politician talking like this. So this is Ronald Reagan. I think if I didn't say who it was, people wouldn't guess that this was Ronald Reagan. He said to the British Parliament, "In an ironic sense, Karl Marx was right. We are witnessing today a great revolutionary crisis. A crisis where the demands of the economic order are conflicting directly with those of the political order. But the crisis is happening not in the free, non-Marxist West, but in the home of Marxism-Leninism, the Soviet Union. It is the Soviet Union that runs against the tide of history by denying human freedom and human dignity to its citizens. It is also in deep economic difficulty. The rate of growth in the national product has been declining steadily since the 1950s and is less than half of what it was then." And then he goes on to say, "We are seeing in Europe the growth of what he calls new schools of economics in England and America and the appearance of the so-called new philosophers in France, all of whom have come to the conclusion, the realization, that collectivism stifles all the best human impulses." So he didn't write that himself, but he believed it. I mean, I think what's striking about that speech is it sounds authentic. It's a pretty serious message. And also, in some respects, he was right. I mean, it's a pretty powerful combination. He sounds like he means it. There's real ambition to the speech. And he was right in a way that many people had not yet perceived. There was a serious crisis in the Soviet Union, and it was a failure both of economics and of legitimacy.
To use another paraphrase from Karl Marx, the Soviet Union was on the edge of being swept into the dustbin of history. That's what Reagan believed. And you asked earlier, can we imagine other presidents giving it with that sincerity and with that level of authority in the speech to invoke Marxism, Leninism, and to, in a sense, reverse the frame of analysis for the purposes of making his point. This is a man who began as a devotee of the New Deal. He's the only president to have been president of a labor union, the Screen Actors Guild, in the late 40s. This is where he encounters communists, because there are many communists in Hollywood at the time, and this is where he develops his deep antagonism to everything communistic. And when his movie career is over and he leaves the union, he doesn't want any more union business anymore. He's employed by General Electric to go around to its 120 plants in the U.S. and to give four-minute free enterprise speeches celebrating the virtues of capitalism, free enterprise, free markets. And because the man was scared of flying, he would go from one General Electric plant to another by train. So he had a lot of time on his hands. And he did a lot of reading. And among the books he was reading in the early 50s was Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. And one of the schools of new economic thinking that is being referred to in that speech is the Chicago School of Economics, which is where Hayek landed, where Milton Friedman landed, where a new school of neoliberal economics is being developed to free the economy from its fetters, to burst it free and to allow economic growth and prosperity and affluence to spread as only free market capitalism can spread it. What's not included in that speech about the tyranny of collectivism is Reagan's belief that there was a continuum between communist tyranny and what he called New Deal tyranny. There was no distinction in his mind between social democracy and communism. There was no distinction in his mind between the politics of the Labor Party and the politics of communism. There was a distinction, but they were on a single continuum and one was going to lead to another. His ambition in the United States is to upend the New Deal settlement, to eliminate the regulatory state, to restore America to a time of the 1880s, the 1890s, where there were no serious regulatory force on capitalist development. So it was quite radical in that sense. And the scary part of what he was proposing and recommending was his insistence that what many Americans regarded as settled, whether that be Social Security, a strong regulatory state, Keynesian tools, those were no longer to be accepted. Those had to be fought and in the best possible world, overturned and eliminated.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I want to ask you one more question about the campaign and then something more about the legacy of this election. So Reagan was an actor. And again, the cliche of the time, we've absolutely unequivocally moved into the age of TV politics. And Reagan came across pretty well on TV. Actually, I think Carter often came across quite well on TV. He was in a different way, in the way that you described, in a different kind of folksy way. He was quite telegenic. This is also the era of the presidential debates. They weren't a novelty. They had been going for a while. And in 1960, there was a significant debate between Kennedy and Nixon. So we're 20 years on from that. But they were important. And in this campaign, there was one two-way debate, a face-off between the two candidates, not that long before polling day, that was thought to have been very significant. And people argue about this all the time. It's with hindsight, you can read significance into these events and see that in the fact that Reagan was thought to have done well in that debate, the sign of the landslide to come. It's possible that actually the landslide makes people with hindsight think that the debate was decisive. Was it decisive? Was this an era? This is an era of not many TV channels and big audiences for these events, you know, the sort of Super Bowl, not quite, but Super Bowl style audiences for these events. Did they shape electoral outcomes?
Carter had a bad debate, and Reagan had a few lines in that debate, which made it into discourse in the days and weeks after and shaped the discussion in the final days leading up to the election. One of those lines was, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And then on another occasion, Carter was engaged in a quite serious discussion. He was an engineer by training, so he was masterful with the details, but could sometimes lose the big picture. And Reagan's only response was, there you go again. And that landed with really powerful effect. Carter made one mistake of his own in terms of talking about the threat of nuclear weapons. He talked about taking advice on nuclear weapons policy from his 12-year-old daughter. And this went over very, very poorly in the discussion that ensued. As we all know, the effort to spin debates goes on very intensely. And so there are armies of pundits ready to launch into action. But this is a case where I think if we judge the success of a debate by the perception of one candidate clearly having had the superior evening, I think this is a case where Reagan clearly came out on top. And if Carter had a stupendous debate, could he have changed the outcome of the election? It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine. And then, of course, the Iranians were trying to humiliate America. They didn't really care whether Carter or Reagan would be president, but there were negotiations to free the hostages going on urgently. This is where Carter had put a lot of his hope, going on urgently until the very last moment. And the interest of the Iranians was just an embarrassing great Satan as much as possible. The deal was done, basically, but they held off actually releasing the hostages until after the election had been decided and Reagan was coming into office. And it was a way of humiliating Carter even further. I don't think they thought that Iran would benefit over the long term from having Reagan as president. I just think it was an effort to humiliate this great power as much as possible and to have an influence on the election as much as they could, just to embarrass the evil empire of the United States.
The 1980 election has gone down in history as a watershed. It signals for many people the end of one era, particularly a era of political economy, New Deal and post-New Deal political economy, and the dawn of an era that's sometimes named after the winner of the election, Reaganomics. And it's partly because it doesn't exactly, but it close enough coincides with a similar shift in Britain. 1979, the election of Margaret Thatcher, again an era named after her Thatcherism, or an idea named after her Thatcherism. And it can be tempting to think of these elections as the decisive event. So the election is the thing that signals the shift. But when you look at it, a lot of the shift has happened before the elections. And you've mentioned it already in Carter's administration. Some of the things that we come to associate with what people, including you in your writings, have called the neoliberal era, were there already. It's true in Britain, too, that the Callaghan administration that came before the Thatcher administration, under pressure of what was happening in the world of international economics and finance, had already moved in a much tighter direction in terms of monetary policy, but also looking at ways in which it could rein in some of the expenditure on social security and other things, tougher with the unions. That shift was already underway, and it could be that these elections, less the cause of the change, were a symptom of a change that was already underway. In the United States, Jimmy Carter had already empowered the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates in a way that was going to lead eventually to very high unemployment, but also to what came to be associated with the Reagan Revolution in economic policy. The Russian invasion of Afghanistan, Carter was already talking much more toughly about not the evil empire, as he called it, but the Soviet Union and the invasion of Afghanistan. So I really do remember that. I mean, if there's one event from my childhood where I think I remember watching the news and being properly scared, it was when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. And there was something reassuring about the thought that there were politicians who were talking tough, but there was also something terrifying about it because the threat of nuclear war was real. But that's Carter. That's not Reagan. Some of this was already underway. You can't take elections as signaling the turning point. They matter, but do we overstate the extent to which 79 in Britain, 80 in America is the dawn of the new era, rather than maybe it is one of the things that signals that the new era has already dawned?
One of the challenges of combining economic and political history is that the time periods under which processes unfold are not the same. We define political time in short, brief spurts defined by elections. The movement out of the New Deal order into the neoliberal order is mammoth tectonic shift in political economy that cannot occur through one election. So the challenge is to understand what is the relationship of the manifest politics to the latent economic changes that are going on. And it's certainly true that I would say the death of the New Deal and the birth of the neoliberal order occurs in the 70s out of the economic crisis and out of necessity. And that Carter is thrust into a situation for which he's not really prepared, but is on the one hand experimental, on the other hand uncertain. And so part of our verdict on the Carter administration is that he doesn't really know in which direction he's heading. So the forces for neoliberalism have been unleashed. The economic toolkit that had sustained the New Deal is no longer working. Lots of people are actively searching. There are all kinds of new policy think tanks in Washington in the 1970s. There are new schools of economics, like the Chicago School of Economics, that are developing new ways of thinking. There are donors who are willing to invest in this new political economy and in this new politics. So the ground by 1980 has been laid, but you also need a general to take command of the forces and to orchestrate the advance and execute the battle plan. And Reagan was that general in the U.S., and I would say Thatcher was that general in the U.K. And yes, Reagan is continuing policies that Carter would occasionally embrace and implement. And there are forces propelling Reagan to embrace the kind of economics that he's going to embrace. But he also has a vision for transformation that he unfurls across a very broad terrain. And if you imagine a different president with less of a vision, it may have happened much more haphazardly and uncertainly. And also, we cannot ignore the fact that throughout this process, there are forces of opposition. The Teddy Kennedy Democratic Party doesn't disappear in the 1980s. It's present in Congress. They are capable of mounting an opposition. They are capable of obstructing some of the things that Reagan is doing. But if you look at the comprehensiveness of the Reagan project, the radical slashing of tax rates on the wealthy, the hard line against organized labor and the desire to break unions, the effort to deregulate mass media in a country that had a robust history of public regulation, the effort to develop a new jurisprudence that would undercut the very constitutional legitimacy of the New Deal, the effort to attack affirmative action at its root as a project of social engineering that in America, in the land of freedom in a small state, was considered illegitimate. If you consider the breadth of the Reagan project, I conclude that this is part of a vision that has been developing for a long time, and that Reagan was a person with such a vision and took critical steps toward implementing it in the 1980s in a comprehensive manner that might not have been executed to the same degree if we can imagine another president being in place. I think if Carter had won, we would see the neoliberal order unfold, but in a much less comprehensive and authoritative way.
There's a counterfactual that British historians are sometimes obsessed with, which is if Callaghan had called an election, as he was tempted at one point to do in the later months of 1978, he would probably have won it. He waited too long. He lost decisively in the election in 79. Had Callaghan called that election in 78 and won it, that would have been the end of Margaret Thatcher, probably. And it would have been exactly the scenario you described, those early neoliberal sort of felt out, tentative, pragmatic forms of political economic reform would have continued, but without the stridency, without the ideological vision, without knitting in an international vision with a domestic vision, including a Cold War vision with a domestic vision. Assuming Carter hadn't won without the alliance across the Atlantic, a version of this happened in France, right, under a socialist president, Mitterrand, who eventually had to abandon that for something that was more pragmatically attuned to the new reality of a emerging neoliberal order. So I completely agree with you, actually. It's sort of half and half. A lot of this would have happened, but it makes a massive difference when it happens under the leadership and in the name of politicians who fully embrace it, as opposed to the ones, I'm not saying it's better or worse, but the ones who do it either reluctantly or by necessity give you a very different politics, even if the political economy has links. One last question. So you mentioned a new jurisprudence. We talked about this in relation to FDR and the New Deal, that some of the enduring significance is in the politics of the Supreme Court. And as you say, one of the challenges of understanding political history is these electoral cycles don't map onto economic, never mind cycles, but shifts. But a challenge, particularly in the United States, is electoral cycles do not map onto shifts in the Supreme Court. That's the whole point of the Supreme Court. It doesn't change in accordance with each new president, but it does change generationally. If you look at the politics of America now, a large part of the legacy of this era, the new era of Reagan politics, is the jurisprudential shift. But that takes a long time to play out in a reconstituted Supreme Court. And maybe it's, you know, the anti-regulatory version of this, the really radical anti-regulatory version, dismantling the whole of Nixon's environmental regulation order, for instance. This is only really happening now with this Supreme Court. I mean, it's a generation plus effort.
Yes. And I was having a discussion with someone whose name I can't remember right now, trying to give a name to this court, the current court in the United States. And he said it's no longer the Roberts Court, the Chief Justice of the United States, because he doesn't control it. And I think the recent decisions have given a lie to the originalist philosophy that's closely associated with Antonin Scalia. And this person said to me, maybe we should call it the Robert Bork Court. Robert Bork was someone nominated by Reagan for the Supreme Court, and this was a huge battle in Congress, and Bork was defeated by Teddy Kennedy, who led the opposition, mostly over issues of civil rights. But Bork's greatest radicalism was his desire to upend the entire regulatory state that was put in place by the New Deal. And we may now be seeing the court that Bork had imagined, that he could never shape himself through his presence because he was denied a seat, but that his philosophy now guides this Supreme Court majority. And it may be that we are seeing a Reaganite jurisprudence being enacted in the 2020s, more than 30 years after the Reagan presidency came to an end.
In one of the many ironies of history, to go back to what we were saying earlier, it's being enacted in the face of Joe Biden's agenda and what his administration would like to do, which has echoes of a much, much earlier politics. You can see history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And you can see some of the things that we've talked about, FDR and the court. As he said, it was Teddy Kennedy who blocks Bork getting on the Supreme Court. We now have a Bork court and a weirdly, newly, in his way, radical president in Joe Biden, and these two versions of a future for America competing with each other in ways that are very now, very 2024, and really do have echoes of earlier generational conflicts.
And it takes us back to the early 20th century, when progressives could not get their legislative packages through because of Bork-like courts, which were perpetually obstructing what Congress was trying to do. Now, the situation in Congress is not quite the same now because Congress is paralyzed in ways in which it was not in the early 20th century. But we can see echoes of a standoff between a majoritarian politics that imagines a certain kind of politics for America and a Supreme Court that says what this majority wants is constitutionally illegal and thus cannot stand. And so we can expect, I think, fights between the Supreme Court and the presidency and the legislature for years to come in ways that echo the struggles of the early 20th century and remind me of the very critical stance that two earlier presidents, one Theodore Roosevelt, the other Franklin Roosevelt, one Republican, one Democrat, took against the court itself. And for those listening to this who are despairing of the current court, it's useful to remind us that eventually, the Rooseveltian attack on the legitimacy of the court produced a court more amenable to majoritarian politics in the United States.
If you would like to sign up for the free fortnightly newsletter that now accompanies this series, just click on the link in the show description and you will see how. Also, do follow us on Twitter to find out more about what's coming up. We're at PPF Ideas. Next time in this series, we have reached the end, not the present, but the election of 2008, our last episode, the election of Barack Obama. It was another watershed in American history. I'm going to be talking to Gary about how it happened, but also about how we got from there to now. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.